Gardner Goldsmith, LG Grande here with you at Liberty Conspiracy Audios. You can find us on iTunes and Podomatic if you just look up Liberty Conspiracy. And you can also find our podcasts embedded in our player at libertyconspiracy.com. Hope you'll visit us. And you can follow me if you want to at Gard Goldsmith on Twitter. Quick introduction for you here for this production, which is actually a fairly short one, and is something that I was inspired to create because of a couple emails, and it turns out that those emails were very prescient, because this is a production that centers on a piece that was in our previous show. In that previous show, we talked about the Securities and Exchange Commission going after Mark Cuban for what they say is insider trading. Well, some of the details on that I did not put into the podcast, although I mentioned them on the radio program, and I decided to make sure that I'm fair to Mark Cuban, and I think Mark Cuban is a pretty decent guy. I wanted to make sure I gave you a complete show that gave you the details about what the SEC is trying to do to Mr. Cuban, and also I think the courageous way that Mr. Cuban is fighting the government, and a slightly different way to look at the idea of so-called insider trading. I'll have comments on that for you, and also have comments on the economic positives of allowing insider trading and trading on information and things like that, and how government regulations against this, government prohibitions against this, and punishments for doing so actually inhibit the free flow of information in a free market. You might have heard part of this, but not all of it. In our last program, I decided to bundle together everything, including the piece that I did not put into the previous podcast, and make a completely separate, unique production that concentrates strictly on the free market libertarian view of government's so-called insider trading prohibitions. I think you'll like it. It has a lot to do with economics. It has some great stuff from Murray Rothbard in here, and information about just what Mr. Cuban is dealing with. And it's too bad that he's dealing with this. From what I can gather, I don't think he's done anything wrong on a personal level or ethical level. And he certainly has done nothing wrong regarding the law, in my view, because the law itself is wrong. So we'll get into this. I hope you like it. And I hope you'll visit our website, libertyconspiracy.com. If you have listened to our previous podcast, there will be some repeated material in this, but there's also some new material for you that sort of gives you the overview of the story about Mr. Cuban. So thank you very much for listening. Hope I'm doing a decent job in covering this and giving respect to all the parties involved in this, from what I can gather, from the standpoint of a guy who believes in freedom and keeping the government out of this. All right, we'll get right to it. Thanks for listening. Visit our website. Be seen. As you know, Mark Cuban is the Dallas Mavericks basketball team owner. And he testified on Monday in front of this Securities and Exchange Commission trial, because they say that he traded in non-public information. So insider trading, right? Now, he's worth $2.5 billion, according to Forbes magazine. He said, and he's a pro-liberty guy, he said he could have paid the fine. It's like $2 or $3 million. He's like, he could have paid that fine. But he decided to fight this because he says he has done nothing wrong. And there's this story here that is not really being covered very well. Let me tell you about it from the Reuters point of view. It says here, Cuban, 55, estimated by Forbes magazine to have a net worth of $2.5 billion, is accused by the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, an unconstitutional and completely immoral body, by the way, of trading in non-public information when he sold his 600,000 shares worth $7.9 million and avoided a $750,000 loss in internet search company Mama.com in June of 2004. Okay. Now, we know he's very outspoken against government regulation and things like that. So, the SEC accuses Cuban of selling the shares soon after learning from Mama.com chief executive Guy Fraure, F-A-U-R-E, that the Montreal-based company was planning a private placement that would dilute the holdings of Cuban and other shareholders. Cuban told jurors on Monday that he had heard in April 2004 of a possible connection between Mama.com and a known stock swindler, the late Irving Kott, K-O-T-T, in a phone call from an investigator with the Federal Bureau of Investigation. He was already questioning the company's integrity, Cuban testified, when he found out about the private placement in June. Mama.com shares dropped 9.3% on the morning after the offering was announced. By that time, Cuban had already sold his shares. Now, something that is very important here is Cuban emailed the company with his concerns a long time before any of this happened. And he said, the reason that the SEC is going after him is because this guy, Guy Fowler, from this company, Montreal-based Mama.com, he claims that he had a verbal agreement with Mark Cuban that he wouldn't say anything about their troubles. So Cuban says, I never do verbal agreements about anything. Why in the world would I do that? And it makes manifest sense. That would be insane. Totally insane. So he sent out letters expressing concern. He has the records of these things. He's in front of a jury. I think it's four women and three men in the jury, and so on and so forth, right? And Cuban even offered this guy Fowler a plane ticket to come down and testify. But the guy wouldn't take the offer. So instead, the SEC presented video testimony from Fowler, who said Cuban told him upon learning of the offering plan, now I'm screwed, I can't sell. In his testimony Monday, Cuban denied making that statement and said, it makes no sense. On multiple occasions, I had said I was going to sell my stock. He said he had never been told the information was confidential, nor had he signed a confidentiality agreement, nor made an oral promise not to share the information about the private offering. Okay, so now, let's pull back from the details about this, right? And let's talk a little bit about insider information, insider trading, all right? Now, people like Murray Rothbard have... A lot of free market folks even today have said that the government interfering and passing statutes about people who get information early and then act on that information is actually a detriment to the market. It holds back information that people could use to actually make the market work more efficiently, so that money isn't lost. And they are right. They are correct. This is something that a lot of people think is sort of counterintuitive. They say, man, is that really the case? I don't know about that. Is that for real? It is for real. A lot of these articles started to pop up when the Martha Stewart case came around. And she wasn't even busted for insider trading. She was busted for not saying the right thing about the conversations that they claimed that she had had. But efficient investors who have good market sense and good information, they should be able to act on that information. And people will watch those guys. And they'll say, wow, did you see that? I'm moving on that. Now, it's possible that someone could do it intentionally to try to hurt some other business. That is possible. But if that is shown, and you have a truly free market, then people might not follow that guy. Look at the non-free market that we have now, with certain, I won't mention them, big-time investors making tons and tons of money through government connections. Right? Oh, I don't know, maybe like Warren Buffett. Through breaking down some companies and dumping shares early, or picking up companies that have been broken down by the government. This sort of stuff. So these sorts of things happen
more often when the government gets involved. And when you have insider trading, this information needs to get out there. Sometimes people won't share the information because they're afraid. So what happens? People lose the opportunity to be able to utilize the information and get out, and then they suffer a loss. That's not good. Now, to play the other side of it here, let's say we've got some sort of a private marketplace, right? Okay, so if you've got a private marketplace and there's no government at all, how would you set up your system? Would you allow for it? Or would you think that that would be a way that people might defraud? What you could do is you could have competing systems, and you could see which one works most efficiently, which one seems to have the most mistakes, which one seems to have, let's say you have insider trading and people are worried. Okay, well, give it a shot. See whether or not people end up, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours, and we won't tell anybody. And all the big wigs are the ones who get all the information. Or you actually get a competitive marketplace in the release of this information, in the digging up of this information, in the sharing of the information. Very interesting. When we come back, we're going to talk about this, hear from Murray Rothbard, and talk about regulation of businesses at Liberty Conspiracy Radio. We're rolling along at Liberty Conspiracy Radio. Okay, and thank you to Gary Vago also for sharing that information about my novella, Bite. Very, very, very much appreciated, Gary. Really appreciate it. And I know there's been some technical things in the show. I apologize about that. But I want to continue, hopefully. And by the way, hopefully when I put this in a podcast, it'll be a really nice packed thing. And hopefully the bulk of the show, you know, 7/8 of it has been pretty good, I hope. But I want to continue talking about this Mark Cuban thing, because there's a lot to learn, I think, at least, maybe not to learn, but at least to discuss. And, you know, I know sometimes it's sort of like a one-way thing, but, you know, I know you're on the other side and we can communicate. You can email me, too, at libertyconspiracy@yahoo.com or Facebook messages, whatever. You can go into the forum at libertyconspiracy.com. But anyway, so I was talking about the Mark Cuban thing and the insider trading stuff. And the thing is that I think a lot of times people are so busy looking at the trees that they miss the forest, right? So they always get bound up in the details about this or that or this or that, and they don't look at the context of the story is always that it's within this government regulation thing, and that somehow so-and-so might have run afoul of this regulation or that regulation or something like that, right? That law or something. So the laws don't necessarily conform to the ways that people would treat each other in real life, and they don't necessarily lead to better outcomes, better consequences. And the Securities and Exchange Commission is not only an unconstitutional entity, which they excuse by an open-ended interpretation of the Interstate Commerce Clause, Section 1, Article 8 of the Constitution, but beyond the Constitution, for people who didn't sign it like you or me, and Mark Cuban, who didn't sign it, people just doing business with each other, it is an immoral imposition of political agendas over common interests. The common interests can be shown in the market. There can be guilds that could start up. There can be all sorts of arrangements whereby if you are in this trading group, you will agree not to do this or that. And if you end up doing something like that, then you're out of that group. You can have all sorts of different organizations that pop up, and sure enough, they can, based on their transparency and not political connections, they can do their stuff and people can see how well they operate. Now, some people say, well, you know, the big guys would be the ones that would get all the power. Okay, I want to play you a couple segments if I can. The first one by Murray Rothbard on insider trading and how it's actually something that should be smiled upon in many cases because it gets information out there and instead the government regulates that information away and people can't act soon enough and they end up losing money in many cases.
Okay, I think... If I haven't succeeded in alienating everybody yet, I may as well go a couple, two more points on the current policies and current issues. One is a thing which irritates me a lot. I don't see much opposition to it, either in the libertarian movement or free market economists. I'm not saying it's not there, I just don't see it. It might be there bubbling underground and I haven't seen it yet. Anyway, we've had in the last few years a veritable reign of terror on Wall Street. Many of us have our least favorite politician. It's very difficult. I think about my least favorite politician. It's very difficult to decide among a rich tapestry of choices. If you focus on this guy, yeah, he's the least favorite. You focus on somebody else, yeah, he's the one. But my particular favorite is Rudolph Giuliani, the heroic Savonarola of Wall Street.
Okay? The Hitler.
The scourge, yes, the scourge of Wall Street. Giuliani, as you probably know, he'll probably be the mayor of New York soon. And his big thing is using the power of the state apparatus, to including all quasi-illegal means, certainly unlibertarian means, to what? To combat the evils on Wall Street. What are the evils on Wall Street? Well, things like insider trading, which is not a concern means. If you talk over a martini, you say, Jim, I know that so-and-so XYZ Corporation is going to merge with ABC Corporation, you're arrested. It's illegal. Somebody's spying on you. It's insider trading, evil. Lock them up. The idea that somehow an unfair advantage, if you know something more than the other guy and therefore profit from it, that's what free enterprise is. It's knowing something more than the other guy and being an entrepreneur and profiting from it, whether it's the stock market or business in general. So this is a direct assault on free markets, and free enterprise, and private property, and all the rest of it. It's a victimless crime, just as much as prostitution and drugs. It's a victimless crime. It also helps the economy by siphoning control and ownership of assets of corporations to the most efficient people, those who know more than the other clucks. Okay? And for this, they are persecuted. The two prominent investment bankers were dragged out of their office in manacles and chains by Giuliani's thugs. And what does the public say about it? I mean, usually optimistic about the public, but not in this sort of situation. They don't understand that. They're good when something taps their pocketbook, like a pay raise or something like that. They can understand that. Something on Wall Street, they're all for it. Yeah, these guys. One of my least favorite news things on television is the men on the street interviews. I don't know whether it's the real men on the street or whether they select it that way. They're a bunch of bozos from beginning to end. And when they arrested some of these Wall Street insider traders, they asked these guys, what do you think? I think the Ivan Boesky kid. What do you think of the Boesky punishment? It's too good for them. It was $1 billion fine and then 5 years in jail and prohibiting him from ever trading his security again. Too good for him. They should lock him up and throw away the key. This seemed to be the modal argument, the modal opinion of the man on the street.
Okay, now I just want to bring up another point here with Rothbard, which I think is pretty key. And that is, to sort of add to what Murray Rothbard had to say, if you look at this in a different way, slightly different way. I want to get my other bit up about Rothbard. Think about people who find out, just consumers, who find out about a really good product before other people, right? Is that wrong? You know, is it wrong that I might know somebody who's making something and happen to think that, wow, that's a really good product, and then I get it and I have extra money left over in a really good product before other people do? Is that wrong? I acted on that information. I went searching around. I found this record or I found this movie, and this is really great. I got it before anybody else did or whatever. Right? Is that bad? It saved me money before other people got to save money. Is that wrong? Some guy tells me about his invention. I got this invention, man. Oh, cool, dude. I'm going to give you some money for that invention. There's no difference, really. Correct? Yeah, I think so. Now, some people say that, yeah, but you know, you got to have the government regulating something, right? You got to have the government because, well, what is a regulation? A regulation is force. So even if you think that there is a positive end to getting the government to punish people for trading on insider information, what you're doing is you are supporting threats of violence and force against people for some action through the government, which has to be paid through taxation, seized plunder, seized money from people. Now, there's another side of this thing. A lot of people think that, well, we got to have somebody to compete against these giant businesses. What if they all join up and unite? Well, as I've often mentioned, check out a great book called The Myth of the Robber Barons or How Capitalism Saved America. Here's Murray Rothbard on government regulation. And where it came from, by the way.
From the Civil War down to about 1900, late 1890s, prices were generally falling, and they were falling for good reason, namely that business was so competitive and the economy was so productive that the supply of goods and services was increasing at a rapid rate. In other words, that's when America industrialized. It was the biggest period of economic growth in the history of the world.
Now, remember how I mentioned if you've got a free market, if you've got government staying out of things and you don't have inflation, you'll actually see lowering prices for things, which is great.
And the standard of living went up, and productivity went up, and prices fell. This did not mean that businesses were suffering because costs were also falling as the productivity increased and mass production increased. So in this situation, the many business groups who tended to be inefficient try to correct this price falling situation by organizing cartels. In other words, by organizing a cartel of each industry so that they could cut production and raise prices. And this was tried in industry after industry, starting with the railroads, which were the first big business in the United States, first large-scale business, and continuing on through manufacturing by the late 18th.
Well, I'll just give you the quick explanation because I know we're running up against the clock, and then I'll finish this off for our podcast audience. Those companies that tried to cartelize couldn't gouge their customers because there was always the threat of competition coming in. In fact, competitors did come in. So, we'll continue with Rothbard for the podcast audience, and thank you very much for listening. All right, podcast audience, let's continue and allow Rothbard to make the point that I just wanted to make sure that we got out to our live radio audience.
In the 90s, either trying through cartels, formal cartels, or through mergers. And in the late 1890s, the theory was, we'll just merge into one big, we'll have one big firm for the entire steel industry, the oil industry, etc., and then we'll be able to cut production and raise prices and raise profits at the same time. So they tried this systematically. This was the ideology, so to speak, among businessmen, that the way to benefit for all of us is to have quotas, either formal quotas as in cartels or in mergers where you just agree that you will have certain shares of this corporation, and then we'll cut production and raise prices. That was the great goal. All of this was a total flopperoo, and case after case, literally hundreds of cases of this kind of merger or cartel, they all flopped. And they flopped for two basic reasons. One is that an economic theory can predict this, and this is confirmed time and time again. Two basic reasons. One is, well, the basic reason is that the industry is free. Government did not step in and force people to accept the cartel or accept the merger. So what happens is that as soon as the cartel is formed or the merger is completed, and then they cut production and raise prices and profits go up, other businessmen come in and say, hey, this looks like a great industry here, the zinc industry or the oil industry or whatever, railroads. They're making a lot of profits. Let's nip in there and outcompete them because they're raising prices, and we're going to now come in with a new firm, a new factory, a new railroad. And we'll bust them, and that's exactly what happened. So you had new competition always coming in, and outcompeting the older firms, and then the older firms are stuck with a new firm. Then you have a permanent competitor, which is a big pain in the neck, because they come in with later equipment, with new factories and new equipment, the latest the latest technology, etc. Now they have a permanent new competitor on their hands. So it became the whole thing became a big pain in the neck for them. And that's one reason. And then internally, what happened was that individual firms would start breaking the cartel. They'd say, look, we raised, in other words, the cartel restricts production, raises prices. Prices are very high. And then the individual firm says, look, I'm not supposed to do this because I have a cartel agreement with the rest of my buddies in the industry. But here's what we're going to do. For you, my old pal and drinking buddy or whatever, then my buyer, I will sell you the steel or the whatever, titanium, et cetera, for 20% off list, provided you don't tell anybody about it. Okay. So what you have is a secret price cutting. And then this firm gains profits, gains sales, and of course the secret leaks out pretty quickly after about 6 months or a year, and then the other firms get very mad about this, and they call it your rate buster, which is in business terms is equivalent to scab in union terms. And the whole cartel falls apart with mutual recrimination and hatred, and they're back where they started, except now they've got more hatred than they had before. So in other words, this system didn't work. The cartel policy and the merger policy flopped. At that point, each step of the way, some of the more far-sighted in the sense of realizing this was a flop among the business groups decided the only way to preserve a cartel or preserve a merger is to have the government enforce it. The turn of the political arm to create the cartel for you. And this was the origin of progressive regulation. The progressive system was not a group of far-sighted essentially, it was not a group of far-sighted intellectuals who sat around and said, we have to plan, we have to curb businessmen for the sake of the public interest. It was a group of groups of businessmen saying, we have to impose cartels through the government, and thereby eliminating our competition, curbing the maverick firm, which doesn't want to engage in a cartel, and gaining profits that way. So, for example, in railroad regulation, the first things they did after the railroad businesses put in the ICC, the Interstate Commerce Commission, the first thing the ICC did was outlaw secret price cutting. Because secret price cutting is always the great instrument by which an individual firm can bust the cartel. And how do you do it? You do it in the name of publicity. You say, well, it's a terrible thing to have a secret price cutting. All prices should be, the book should be open. All firms should release publicity about their prices and costs and et cetera, so the public will know, the right to know, and all that jazz. What it really meant was, we want to know what our competitors are charging, and we do it by making the government make all of us release, open the books. So anyway, this is, and of course you do this in the name of openness or democracy or whatever, in the name of the public interest, because America was born in an anti-monopoly ideology. A hatred of monopoly, meaning, by the way, monopoly meant for centuries, until modern economics came in and poisoned the well, so to speak. What monopoly meant was very simple. It meant a grant of special privilege on the part of the government to different businesses for exclusive production or sale of a product, period. It didn't mean a large firm. It didn't mean a differentiated product and all the rest of it. And it's meant very simply, grant by the government of exclusive privilege. It's very much like during the discussion of Professor Peden before, that when the church fathers attacked the rich, they didn't mean the rich period, they meant tax collectors and so forth. It's a similar situation, a shift in the language. So how could they sell this to the American public? How could these business groups sell this, a compulsory cartel system, to the American public? They can't say, we want compulsory cartels. So what they did was, they created the ideology of the public interest. This is the public good. We have to curb evil business groups and sort of stuff. And the businessmen who took this position were then called enlightened by their allies, by the media, whatever, the media of that epoch. These are enlightened businessmen who rise above their own self-interest to look at the larger good. They have the far vision of, like Diocletian. they want to curb their selfish profits for the good of the entire industry and the good of the country. Now, how was this ideology pushed? The ideology was pushed very simply by intellectuals who were rising up. Throughout history, the statism has been imposed by two groups, an alliance of two groups, the state itself, the state apparatus, the king, the throne, and the opinion molding groups, the intellectuals, which in most cases in history have been the churches, the state church. And so this is known as the alliance of throne and altar. You have the church and the state. The church
The function of the church was to tell the people to obey the state. The state is God in many cases. The king is God. The king is divinely sanctioned. And in return for this, and the public believes them, because they are the intellectual opinion molders, and in return for that, the church gets part of the boodle. They get part of the state revenue in the form of tax subsidies and so forth. So this is a very cozy alliance until, especially Western Europe, until the age of Western Europe, and when church and state were separated. And essentially, in the progressive period in the early 20th century, you begin to reform the old alliance of intellectuals and government, big government intellectuals, who perform the function of court apologists for the new regime. And informing the public, this is the public interest, the common good, the general welfare, and all the rest of it.
There you go. Good stuff from Murray Rothbard. And you can find that on YouTube. Liberty Penn is the person who has posted this, or the organization that has posted this. So great stuff. And I just wanted to make sure I got that out there to you. And brought up a little different perspective on the idea of government telling people that they can't trade on this information or can't trade on that information. And I'll leave it to you to think about how you might set something up if you had a private society, and what would consist of bad dealings, what would consist of good dealings. And then you could compare how your private society worked compared to other private societies and different organizations for trading and things like that. To me, that's the way to go, and people can voluntarily sign up to the ones that allow or don't allow that sort of stuff. So thank you so much for listening to this extended show, and I hope you'll go to our website, libertyconspiracy.com, of course. I am Gardner Goldsmith, and I'm not signing off with Ferb or with anybody else now in this extended portion of the podcast version of the show, but I will just say thank you for listening. Don't forget that awesome novella. It's called Bite, and you can find it at GardnerGoldsmith.com, or you can also go to PendragonPress.net and order a copy. And so I think I got the plug in, and thanks very much for joining me on this program. Be seeing you.
You must obey the dance commander, giving out the order for fun. You must obey the dance commander, you know that he's the only one who gives the orders here. All right. It would be awesome if we could dance. It would be awesome, yeah. Let's take the chance. It would be awesome, yeah. Let's stop the show. Because you never know, you never know, you never know until you go. Ready to sin. Radio message from HQ. Dance Commander, we love you. Let's get this party started right, y'all. Let's get this party started right. I went to the store to get more fire to start the war.